Welcome to Lectionary Call-In for Tuesday, August 3rd of 2021, where two laypersons, a pastor, and an academician gather for about 50 minutes each week to discuss the Gospel Lectionary for the coming Sunday, and this Sunday is August 8th. Each Tuesday, we call in from wherever we may be at 6:30 a.m. Eastern Time, and for our friend Charles Willard in Minnesota, that's 5:30 a.m. Thank you, my friend. Our little team's working to be faithful to Lectionary Year B, and that puts us in the Gospel of John today, and we hope this discussion will provide areas of focus and reflection. Here's how it works. We develop perspectives independently after the leadoff person shares some formative questions, and then in this virtual discussion room, we share and encourage and challenge each other. And here are the folks joining us in today's discussion.
Bill Hall in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Sarah Mickelson in Tampa, Florida.
Charles Willard in Maple Grove, Minnesota.
Don Upton, I'm in Columbus, Ohio today. And our leadoff person today is our friend Bill Hull. He's going to read the scripture and get things started. How are you doing, my friend?
Doing well, thank you. And welcome to my fellow team members, and welcome to those joining our dialogue later. We welcome each one and trust that somehow through our considering and sharing, we can help each other grow in our faith. A reminder that we are in the midst of a six-week study of one chapter of John, the sixth chapter. The fact that those who shaped the lectionary chose to spend 6 weeks in this chapter, I'm going to assume is a clear signal that they considered this chapter to be critically important and worth some, if I may say, mulling and searching. So trusting their wisdom, we are in the midst of this 6 weeks journey. Today's passage begins where we ended last week and then jump several verses. So I will be reading John chapter 6, verse 35, then verses 41 through 51. And I read from the New Revised Standard Version. This is God's word for us. Let us listen. Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never be hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty." Then reading from verse 41. Then the Jews began to complain about him because he said, "I am the bread that came down from heaven." They were saying, "Is not this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How can he now say, 'I have come down from heaven'?" Jesus answered them, "Do not complain among yourselves. No one can come to me unless drawn by the Father who sent me, and I will raise that person up on the last day. It is written in the prophets, 'And they shall all be taught by God.' Everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to me. Not that anyone has seen the Father except the one who is from God. He has seen the Father. Very truly I tell you, whoever believes has eternal life. I am the bread of life. Your ancestors ate manna in the wilderness and they died. This is the bread that comes down from heaven so that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats of this bread will live forever, and the bread that I give for the life of the world is my flesh." The word of the Lord, thanks be to God. Now, my first question, and Sarah, I'll come to you in a moment to begin. As will happen again in this portion of our lectionary journey through the sixth chapter of John, the passage begins, as I've noted, by repeating the verse we ended with last week, which said, Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never be hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty." In this section, the people respond by complaining, or some translate it murmuring. Jesus then commands them not to complain or murmur, and focusing particularly on that interchange, but the broader passage, what does this interchange about telling us the people murmured and Jesus commanded them to stop, what does this interchange tell us about ourselves as human, and how does this interchange inform and enhance our understanding of who Jesus is? What do we learn about ourselves? What do we learn about Jesus? Sarah?
I'm reminded of a very short conversation I had with a 3-year-old that said, "I do myself," wanting to open a carton of milk and knowing full well that carton of milk was going to end up all over the room. It was worth the dialogue. I see, or I wonder about this grumbling, and is it an echo of the hometown rejection that Jesus experiences when we read about it in the book of Mark, probably about 2 months ago. I'm thinking about how the grumbling response is, we know who you are and where you've come from. And I'm thinking about how that invokes a doubt about Jesus being anything other than what the working authority had cast him to be. And I think about how restrictive that is from a responsive understanding to a person one-on-one, but also from a group perspective. We see the same crowd questioning his authority, not only in his hometown and here as well, but we see it later when he enters Jerusalem. So I'm thinking of this as a seedling of the "you can know the mind of God better than God" temptation that was offered in the garden as well. So I'm hearing language that implies that humanity is still stuck in that groove of I want to be the one to call the shots, and I want to be the one that can tell you how the story will go. Humanity seems to be persistently comfortable and content operating under that illusion that we know better. And I'm curious about that because I think that's a human nature characteristic. I know I suffer under it, and I'm sure others do too. I'm just thinking about, do we prefer the small talk of physical food instead of the deeper need for spiritual sustenance that's being offered? And I'm wondering how often in our arrogance do we elect to be unteachable, self-assured in our own knowledge, and blind to the gifts being offered? You know, it could be as simple as a vaccination. Yet Jesus persists and continually reaches out. So I think we see this interesting contrast between how creation responds to the Creator and how the Creator continues in his persistence to reach us and to reach out, offering sustenance to all that are hungry, to all who are hungry, and who live under the full weight of that vulnerability and awareness of living in an impoverished state. It's almost like if you realize how poor you are, it's easier to receive. If you function under the understanding that you can do it yourself and you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps, it's really difficult to articulate how you need a Messiah, how you might need daily sustenance, how you might need assurance. So I'm spending some time moving between the crowd and the disciples and Jesus on this one, and thinking about how often we wander away from a gift that's being offered because we don't perceive it as a gift. That was my answer to your question.
Thank you. I appreciate the reminder that this echoes the hometown rejection. I made a note of that. That hadn't occurred to me. So that the hometown rejected, even now a larger audience, at least some of them are, if not overtly rejecting, they're certainly pushing back. Don, what do we learn about ourselves as humans, and what do we learn about Jesus in this interchange?
I learn about myself because, working on what Sarah was saying, I need confidence, and I need confidence derived from crowds. If that makes me very human, I am not self-assured. I need crowds to make me self-assured. I am drawn to it. I think that makes me human, and I think this passage is meant to wake me up to that. I need a crowd. I like a crowd. I can affirm myself with a crowd. I can be assured when I doubt with a crowd. A crowd is a great tool for me. And I think that's what Jesus said, you know, stop grumbling isn't like, you know, he doesn't go pay attention over here. It's like, stop grumbling as if the grumbling and the grumbling in the crowd is an obstacle. You know, it's more like Jesus saying, stop the storm. No time, no patience for that. It doesn't get us anywhere. It's an obstacle. Just like I would say, if I turn my little head to see what the crowd wants to do, I can hear my teacher's voice from elementary school. It'd be something like, oh, I'm over here, Donnie. Jane doesn't have the answer. Why are you looking at Bobby and Jane? They don't have the answer for you. Look here. It's that obstacle, right? And Jesus is teacher. So I'm sure, you know, your question was what, for myself, what do I see myself in there? And it's a reminder that I like crowds. I could go far ahead in that and go, can we talk about clickbait? Can we talk about likes and hearts and little angry face emojis too? Maybe so. Maybe there's crowds in that too. You know, how many likes did we get? Don't look over at the likes. Don't get clicks. I'm over here. And Jesus doesn't seem to be patient with it, just like he doesn't patience with the storm getting in the way of the boat getting across the lake. Get out of the way. It doesn't work. And Sarah, you're referencing the garden. I would say look at the first chapter of John. See chapter 1 in the beginning. The word was with God. Over here, you cannot interpret that with the crowds, or in today's language, you're not going to be able to do that with social media. It's not going to be crowd determined. It is what it is. I am who I am. And then I'm going to say, back to school. I wish I'd thought about this in ninth grade, because my teacher would say, Donnie, you're mixing metaphors in my English class. And now I know I could say, oh, it's okay. Jesus did it all the time. Jesus did it. Why can't I mix my metaphors? So I'm going to play with that and go, all right, let's look at the sheep and the shepherd, the grumbling sheep. I'll mix this up all the way. The sheep are acting as one organism here, which doesn't make any sense. The sheep scatter. They need a shepherd. But here are the sheep grumbling and trying to determine who they are and trying to determine what creation looks like without a shepherd. Makes no sense at all. The sheep are just as scattered, talking to each other and coming up with their own ideas about who they are and where they're going. It's a mess. It's still a mess. It's still sheep with no shepherds. So I'm going to throw in the sheep as well. It's like the madness of crowds is actually in the crowd's belief that they have wisdom or that they can generate wisdom. So that's what I've got, Bill.
Thank you, Don. Charles, your thoughts on this question?
I admit I'm puzzled, and I'm puzzled because I think our natural, inevitable, almost instinctive reaction to a story like this is to treat it as a report of an event that John experienced and was reporting on and describing as it happened. And I don't believe that's the way it worked. I believe that John has created a scene partly from his memory, partly from his commitment, partly from his belief. But we're treating it as though John was giving us here a collected, recorded witness to a particular event that happened reasonably shortly before it's now being reported. And we know from, to the extent we can know these things, we know that in fact John's reconstruction, and I'll describe it that way, John's reconstruction of the life of Jesus was designed many decades after his experience of the life of Jesus and these events he's recording. So he is constructing a narrative here. He's not recording a narrative and giving it to us. He's constructing a narrative that serves his own purpose. His own purpose is to build upon faith, build upon belief, build upon et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not as though John is telling us something that happened. He's telling us his reconstruction, and is not only his reconstruction, but his reinterpretation of those events that happened at that particular time. And it makes a difference. And I'm sometimes troubled by the fact that we simply go from Mark to John, assuming that they are, you know, sitting next to each other and writing these things and comparing stories. They're not. John has created a completely different narrative, completely different interpretation of the life of Jesus, and it's we ought to think about that when we're actually then taking it and using it as the same kind of lens through which Mark and Matthew and Luke were looking. It's not. It's a very different lens.
Okay. Thank you, Charles. I think what I'm going to share is in some ways echoes what has already been said. I'll begin by making a comment that I've made before. I value an awareness, an attempt to be aware of that we're reading all of this centuries later out of a different culture. But I am more and more convinced that there are universals in the human experience. Now, we can experience them or express them differently. But, for example, grief is in the Old Testament, and we grieve today. This week, those of us who read Richard Rohr, he's focusing on grief and very hopefully and in a rich way talking about that experience and what we can learn from it. So for me, this passage does deal with some of those human universals. And my way of saying it would be, in terms of what we learn about ourselves, that we often focus on argumentation or other forms of one-upmanship so that we miss what's really going on. We see that in our world today, how little attempt there is to understand someone, but there's an immediate comeback, a dismissal, name-calling. We're all familiar with that. How little real dialogue there is, and many people have urged us in writing and in other ways to slow down and say, tell me more. Stephen Covey's Fifth Habit, seek first to understand, then to be understood. How little that happens. And so for me, this reflects that. They instantly start arguing with Jesus, and I think it's clear that they dismiss him. Now, what caught my attention was that having grown up when I did and going to seminary when I did, when there was a great enamorment with so-called non-directed counseling, that you never told people what to do. You just simply reflected back what they were saying. Jesus didn't take that course. He immediately says, if I may be allowed to paraphrase, stop it. Grammatically, the people murmuring is in a verbal tense, meaning they were continuing to do this. They had begun and they continue. It's so-called imperfect. This is an ongoing activity. Jesus' response is in the present imperative. In other words, now. Stop murmuring. Stop arguing. And I thought, I kind of like that. I think there's a place at times to say, stop it. We do it as parents. But I've been in some adult-to-adult, if you looked at driver's licenses, you'd think they were adults who are arguing, and someone has the courage, in effect, to say, stop it. We're not listening to each other. We're not dealing with the real issue here. So to me, it reflects the human tendency to look for a way to dismiss something that we don't understand or that's uncomfortable or that is puzzling. And we know that Jesus was confronted. Maybe the most dramatic illustration is the so-called cleansing of the temple where he drove people out. But he confronted the disciples. He said to them at times, I've been with you all this time and you still don't understand. And somebody else used this term, I don't remember who. This preacher spoke of Jesus's holy or sacred impatience. That their impatience can be a gift. In fact, saying enough, we're missing the point. And this preacher said that Jesus's sacred impatience was a gift to those who had ears to hear and eyes to see. In other words, it can be an invitation to come back and see what is needed. And what we learn about Jesus is reflected in a brief quote I'll read from Caroline Lewis's commentary on John. She's saying that what Jesus is offering them is abundant life. Abundant life with God is not a postponed promise for the end times, but a present materiality here and now. In other words, in the here and now, I am the bread of life. There is in me an abundance. And that's clearly, I think, why John invests 71 verses in dealing with this image of the human hunger and the kind of hunger that Jesus satisfies. Interestingly, next week, Sarah, you're going to lead us in the following passage where it immediately says the Judeans once again quarreled among themselves. So how did they respond to Jesus? They got back into, now they're arguing with each other, not just with Jesus. So that again to me reflects the human tendency to engage in, Don, you reminded us, crowd mentality, groupthink, where they argue rather than seeking to understand. Thank you, colleagues. Now we move to question two, and Don, I'm going to come to you in a moment. By my count, using the New Revised Standard Version, words about the human hunger, bread, loaves, food, manna, hungry, and eat, occur 35 times in the 71 verses of John 6. Clearly, John is seeking to focus our attention on the analogy between human hunger and the person and ministry of Jesus Christ. Using this food analogy, what meanings do you find for your own personal faith journey, and what guidance might we find for our corporate lives as followers of Jesus Christ? I'm asking us to speak personally about how that analogy speaks to us and how might it speak to our corporate lives together. Don?
I like the order of the questions as it ties to the first one when we talk about crowds, and I was role-playing as honestly as I could, saying I like crowds. I like affirmations of crowds. I like belonging. I like hiding in crowds. And here we have, I think, maybe you can be satisfied with arguing in a crowd, because there's an affirmation in that too. That the grumbling isn't necessarily dissension. The grumbling is we grumble together. Let us gather and grumble together. All together now. It feels good, doesn't it? Tastes good. I like it. We want two more.
We grumble together.
Yes, very good, girl. Yes, let us go and grumble together. Tastes good. Are you satisfied? No, I want to grumble some more. Let's stay at the table. Let's have another. A little more, please. My friend and I grumble together all the time. It's wonderful. So, you know, let's eat that. And I think we can be satisfied. So I'm going to throw that into the mix of we like crowds. We like the affirmation of crowds. I should say I like. And so what does it mean? You know, does it mean, it means that maybe I need to be careful and offer up a prayer? I need to understand that, that you walk into a room, what are you doing? What are you looking for? Yeah, I think I've raised in these discussions in the past, I had a boss, a beloved boss, who means so much to me many, many, many years ago. And, you know, he, whenever he walked in a room, didn't matter. He'd go, what are you doing? The people would jump and, oh, my gosh. But it was always fun, and I actually use that, too, because it's like every now and then there's somebody in the room going, what am I doing? It could be a group of employees eating lunch. He would walk into the break room and go, what are you doing? You know, and they're like, oh, what are we doing, actually? It's a wake-up call. So back to the core question on bread and hunger. I think if you're facilitating a class or a discussion, I wonder if it's possible to turn our heads to hunger exclusively. It helped me this week with this very difficult question. Not bread, hunger. You know, there's lots of bread out there. Bread of grumbling, bread of crowds, bread of a great dinner, bread of, we can all be satisfied in many ways. There's lots of bread. You know, not the bread of life, but there's a lot of bread. I can fill my belly. Yeah, I'm an American. I can literally fill my belly anytime I want to, I think. But what is hunger? So let's separate hunger. Not a full belly, not bread, exclusively hunger. And the idea is God made me hungry. God did not make me full. I'm not saying God made me a star, but God made me hungry, that this metaphor can stick without the bread. And what I want to get across is not thinking about eliminating it, but meditating on hunger means that that is a constant part of my life. Hunger is something that is with me all the time. It is a constant. It is connected to survival. Even if you have wealth, you must be fed. You must always be fed. Always, always, always. So it's a constant. So I'm just dwelling on hunger. Hunger is human. Hunger is fundamental, scientifically fundamental. You're not hungry. If you don't have the ability to be hungry, you would forget to eat, and actually that could be an issue for some people. Hunger allows you to survive. Hunger is personal. Hunger is as personal as you can get. It is also shared. The crowd can be hungry too. The crowd may need to feed each other. So I'm throwing that out with the idea that getting into the Christology of this is God made me hungry. And there is an understanding in that fundamental. And they have to tackle that first and affirm that before we get to the next thing. And that Jesus is in the hunger. That God is in the hunger. And that so this is meditating on the empty belly, not the bread at all. So that's kind of my starting point, though.
Thank you, Don. Sarah?
Wow, so many big ideas. It dawned on me that Esau bargains away his birthright for stew. And that as human beings, we are frequently grabbing at what's close at hand to fill the hunger in our lives. And the thing that may be closest at hand may be the worst possible thing for us to try to jam into that hunger. Like, I'm hungry, I should eat protein and fruit, and my hands reach straight for the potato chips, which is a very simple example. So I'm challenging myself to think about this the way John tells our story. John, in the book of John, Jesus often uses language that has dual meaning, and that it, in this particular matter, the language about bread, Jesus talks about a specific human need for physical food. And we can take it at that value, but recognize, I think, also that Jesus is talking about a deeper spiritual hunger and offering us sustenance that will fill that gap. I think this pricks a sense of self-awareness and vulnerability and intimacy that many of us are not comfortable confessing or even experiencing. It's so much easier to grab the thing closest at hand and solve the immediate physical need and never actually acknowledge and recognize and seek to resolve our spiritual hunger. So I'm challenging myself to think about temporal versus longitudinal resolution for this hunger that I'm given. Is the hunger the thing that draws us to our Creator? Is the hunger the thing that makes Jesus the solution that we find time and time again to meet that need? We need daily bread. And I'm reminded of that in the prayers that we pray, in the story of the Israelites wandering in the desert and manna coming daily. And Jesus understands that we need so much more to thrive. And so I'm going to fall back into or lean into Caroline Lewis's language about abundance and abundant life. It's not just existence that Jesus is bringing to the table. It's the abundant life that Jesus is bringing to the table. And the real satisfaction comes when we take or accept the offering of his presence as both a spiritual food that gives us energy to go even further, to move toward that. And as much as we need physical food, I think we need that spiritual feeding as well.
Thank you, Sarah. And again, I appreciate your reminding us of the Esau experience. Thank you. Charles?
No comment.
Okay. I'll springboard off of that, Sarah. It reminds me of Jesus' statement in the Sermon on the Mount, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, they shall be filled." Can you hear me? We just had a power surge here. Okay. There's a thunderstorm going on, so I'll trust my colleagues. If I disappear, they will continue. I've asked us to think about how this speaks to us personally, and to use an analogy. During the pandemic, I gained a fair amount of weight and reached a point where I wanted to change that, and I have been able to lose what I gained and much more. One of the resources that I've used advocates what it calls mindful eating. The program stresses that you not guilt yourself, you not fuss, but that you be mindful of what you're ingesting. And there are various disciplines that it offers to increase one's mindfulness. And if I may use one example, I exercise regularly. And some of the equipment that I use here in our retirement center, at the end of the walk on the treadmill or whatever, it will estimate how many calories you've consumed. When I began this program, I discovered that based on that estimate, I would come home and eat what I thought was a rather small breakfast and consume more calories in 10 minutes or 50 than I had exercised in an hour and a half. Wake up call. So I like that mindfulness. And I think what Jesus, when he says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness," he's saying, if you hunger for ego, you won't be satisfied. But if you hunger, because to me, righteousness has to do with the communal, with the corporate. If you care more about the greater good than you do your own good, there will be a kind of satisfaction that comes. One of the passages this week in the lectionary list is from 1 Kings 19, Elijah after his victory on the mountain, and he's out there alone. I alone am left. Let me just die. And we read, "The angel of the Lord came a second time, touched Elijah, and said, 'Get up and eat, Otherwise, a journey will be too much for you. He got up and ate and drank. Then he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God, where then God met him in the image of earthquake, wind, and fire. The Lord wasn't in it, but the Lord was in a still small voice. He was fed physically, which prepared him then to gain some new insight that God offered him. I think in some ways all of that's involved in Jesus's repetitively telling the people that Jesus is the bread of life. We do remember from Deuteronomy, the 8th chapter, humans do not live by bread alone. From Psalm 34:8, O taste and see that the Lord is good. Happy are those who take refuge in him. And I think what it says to me in my own journey and ours together is that John is, in effect, insisting that in Jesus there is an abundance of meaning and purpose to life in God. We don't have to fully understand the metaphor. And I think this is another human universal, I think. Metaphors, analogies, images are to awaken our imagination. And I think sometimes we overthink these passages. We get locked in our heads. But I think what John is wanting to do is to reach into the deeper parts of ourselves. My fantasy is that John knew that Matthew, Mark, and Luke had offered their version. John did not need to repeat the birth narrative. There are other things that John did not repeat. In one example, many of the parables, or maybe all of them. So John is seeking to be used of the Spirit to draw us into a deeper, imaginative, freer space. And then one of the scholars I consulted, Aubrey West, said, it had not been long in narrative time since they'd gathered around Jesus on the side of a mountain, hungry with no place to buy food, earlier in this chapter. Taking a few loaves of barley bread and a couple of fish, Jesus, and using her language, had catered a belly-busting feast for them with enough pieces left over to fill 12 baskets. This magnificent gift represented the abundance of God and should have reminded them of the true bread, Jesus, who gives life to the world, end of her quote. Again, I think Aubrey West is inviting us into some even playful imagination about the abundance of God. Thank you. My third question, based on the style of communicating in John 6 and throughout John, what other images or analogies might we use today to understand for ourselves and share with others the person and work of Jesus Christ? I'm building on my emphasis, which others have said better than I, about engaging our imagination. Now, it is a given that anything I offer or any of you offer will be imperfect. I'm inviting us to seek to be imaginative how we might today communicate about God's abundance or any facet of the gospel that we want to use. So we won't find a perfect analogy. One that comes to my mind, I have not been able to watch much of the Olympics, but I watched, and I don't remember their names or what countries they represented, the two male high jumpers. They ended in a tie and were offered, I forget the term, a kind of a one-off, you know, one more jump and let's see who wins. And you know what they did? They decided that both of them would get a gold medal. And last night I saw a replay of each of them putting the gold medal on the other and experiencing friendship. Frankly, I have over the years become a bit cynical about the Olympics. They were supposed to be for amateurs. It seems to be anything but that. But I thought, there is an image of the kingdom of God. there's enough gold medals for all of us. There's enough recognition and acknowledgement for all of us. I don't have to win at the expense of your losing. Now, another passage in this week, this coming Sunday's lectionary, is from Ephesians 4. And I'm asking myself, Jesus says he's the bread of life. What if I really believe that? What if we really believe? How will that change the way we live? And I think this Ephesians passage is a powerful description for us. And I'm going to read these verses in a moment and invite us to ponder on them. And again, let our imaginations be at work. Here is the writer of Ephesians telling me and us what would happen if I really believed that in Jesus Christ there is the abundance that I need. So then, putting away falsehood, let all of us speak the truth to our neighbors, for we are members one another of one another. Be angry, but do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger, and do not make room for the devil. Thieves must give up stealing. Rather, let them labor and work honestly with their own hands, so as to have something to share with the needy. Let no evil talk come out of your mouths, but only what is useful. But only what is useful for building up as there is need, so that your words may give grace to those who hear. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, with which you were marked with a seal for the day of redemption. Put away, oh my, all bitterness and wrath and anger and wrangling and slander, together with all malice, and be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another as God in Christ has forgiven you. Therefore, here's a powerful image, be imitators of God as beloved children, and live in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. For me, that is one powerful description of what life would be like. You don't lie. You don't hurt with your anger. You don't take from others. And I love this tender-hearted forgiving one another, and that your words may give grace to those who hear. Wow. Don.
Well, I'll build on your story of the two Olympic athletes. What is, I don't think there's a search for nothingness. I think there's always a search for something. And in retelling the story, you know, whether it's exactly accurate or not, I would say the two athletes could have conducted a jump off all night long. They could have gone on and on and on, exerting calories on and on and on, because that's the way it works. Neither of them knew, if I remember this properly, and I think it's a story, this works, neither of them knew that two gold medals were even possible. And I think it's the judge in the story who matters. They, I believe one of them almost in a kind of ludicrous way went, what, we're going to have two gold medals? And he goes, yes, you may. And I was like, oh, didn't think about that. Didn't know that was an option. So I want to turn my little head to the judge. They didn't know that was possible. It was beyond all understanding. And I bet if you'd asked every athlete on the course that night, they'd say, well, we're going to have a jump off till there's a winner. They wouldn't have, how about two gold medals? Oh, no, never. That's not possible. That's not something I ever would have thought of. It's impossible. So some of those other examples would be, because I'm going to go with something. Not that we deny all possibilities. We take some and restrict ourselves by that. So it'd be like gravity. I accept the fact that gravity exists and influences the world. Let's go a step further. There could be a point of singularity out of which no light can escape. Well, no, that's a little much for me. I'll just stick with gravity. Thank you. About, humans can run really fast. And with technology, they can go even faster. Well, that's, I agree with that. So we can go fast and fast. We have cars. How about breaking the sound barrier? How about beyond the speed of light? Oh, no, not at all. You have to prove that to me. No. I mean, so I'm working with things that are actually real, and we accept something. I'm satisfied. Maybe I should say after each of those, I'm satisfied. There's a court case where justice was done, and the whole world watches, an American courtroom. Justice is done. Are you satisfied? Well, yes, I am. Well, no, what do we need to do to create access to justice for all people? Oh, I'm exhausted. No, I think justice was done. I'll take that. Thank you very much. I'm satisfied. I'm satisfied that there's gravity. I'm satisfied that there's some justice in the world. That will do. Thank you. 2 gold medals, beyond all understanding. Beyond the speed of sound, for some, impossible. Beyond the speed of light, impossible. What I'm trying to offer up is we're looking for something, you know, to be sure we're existing in some room, in some space, with a crowd of people that would agree with us, and maybe sometimes agreeing with us, like I think every athlete on the field would agree with, which is you're going to have to jump against each other all night until there's a winner. Do we all agree on that? Yes, we do. Grumble, grumble, grumble. We all agree. Let's watch these two compete all night long. So thank you for that analogy, Bill.
Thank you, Don. Sarah?
So I thought about your question, and I'm thinking about what does modern evangelism have to learn about how we speak to each other from the chapter 6 of the book of John. And there's some really powerful things to be said about, and you said it yourself, engaging the imagination to problem solve something that's recognizable in the human condition. I'm hungry, my human condition. If I can connect that to a universal truth, thank you, Bill, for that language, I have arrived at a way of communicating to someone else that they will recognize. I thought about Michael Pollan's work in the book Cooked, which is described as a natural history of transformation. And I thought about his effective use of 4 classical elements, fire, water, earth, and air, to talk about how human survival has been influenced by moving sustenance through these particular stages. And it's simply a happy accident of water or rainwater falling on grain that had been ground caused a fermentation to occur. And somebody said, well, hey, let's cook that and see what happens. And bread was created. Now, that was 6,000, 8,000 years ago, we guess. But it's an interesting idea that human ingenuity combined with divine grace arrived upon a metaphor that we can use regularly to talk to each other about sustenance and about nourishment that is not based on food. And that, you know, I would say of all the things, it's one of the more ancient metaphors we could lean back on that Jesus brings to us as an I am statement. And so I thought about these I am statements and how they are a recognizable human condition or human need and a specific engaged imaginative way of bringing us all along in the story. We all recognize the elements that Jesus uses in his I am statements. I am the light. I am the gatekeeper. I am the good shepherd. These are easy and what I call palatable, pun intended, palatable words and palatable metaphors that bring us further or invite us into a deeper relationship with our Creator. It's beyond satisfaction, but I love, Don, that you acknowledge we stop at that. It's like, oh, okay, well, I've met my need, my immediate need. I'm done. Or I'm satisfied that justice was served. I don't need to dig any deeper into that story. I recognize that something has occurred that was unfair, unjust, and historically untenable. But I think we've met that need. We've talked about it enough. We don't have to do anything that would acknowledge the longitudinal impact on a whole segregation of people. And so I invite us to consider reconciliation as a part of the story. And that until we resolve that we opted out and took, to the, just if you will, the physical satisfaction path instead of taking the spiritual growth path, which is more difficult, we've opted out or co-opted out, if we will, of God's plan. And I'm curious about that and how our natural history of transformation as a human, as humans, has limited us in that way. We have not transformed because we never really digested the food that we've been given. So I'm thinking about how do we communicate with each other? And I think we, if we acknowledge our own human weaknesses, it brings us closer together.
Thank you, Sarah. Charles?
This is a wild question. I was just looking at the last verse in the section we have today, verse 51 in chapter 6. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats of this bread and will live forever. And the bread that I will give them, I give for the life of the world, is my flesh. And I thought, such a striking statement by Jesus. I wonder if any of the other Gospels used that. And I went to check in the parallels, and I find that neither Matthew nor Mark nor Luke has anything comparable to...
Right.
John 6:26-59. So I'm asking myself, how do I account for that? Did all three of them miss it? Or is this something that John has created from a different context? So it just leaves me wondering. I'm simply sharing a puzzle. I don't understand how something so striking as this could have been just overlooked by both Matthew and Mark and Luke. I don't.
Thank you, Charles. Don.
Thank you. And we are out of time. We'd love to take another hour and talk about this. And for those listening in, I hope you will continue. I hope, like me, you are not satisfied today yet. I'm still hungry, and this makes me hungrier for more conversation. And for folks listening in, Palmacia Presbyterian Church is at 3501 West San Jose Street. That's in Tampa, Florida. And for more information, you can go to palmacia.org. That's palmacia.org. At that site, you will find other discussions of the gospel lectionary passages, great sermons, classes, discussions of other texts, outstanding music, prayers, reflections. So check that out. And you're always welcome. And we'll see you next time.